In 1763, Britain won an unexpected victory in the First World War, which is usually called the French and Indian War, or in Europe, the Seven Years' War. In America, it's not called the Seven Years' War because it lasted for 9 years, actually beginning in 1754 instead of 1756, as in Europe. What happened here was that a Virginia colonial militia major, unknown to any of the authorities in Britain and virtually unknown to people in Virginia, finding French forces in the western part of what is now Pennsylvania, decided on his own authority to attack them. And so this militia major, George Washington, had launched the world on a major war. The war ultimately would be fought in India, in the Caribbean, in the Mediterranean, in Europe itself, and in North America. It had two chief effects. One was to give the British substantial additional colonial empire, making Britain what it would be until after World War II, the dominant power in India. It also led to Britain's acquisition of what had been the French colonial possession of what then was called Canada, essentially what we now call Quebec. And besides this territorial acquisition, the other chief gain to the British from the Seven Years' War was a substantially augmented national debt. Now, Britain's tradition, its military tradition, was that since it was an island nation, it would maintain substantial navy all the time, and the navy essentially controlled this natural moat around Britain, whether you're talking about the English Channel, the Irish Sea, the North Sea. And so, in the first instance, the British could rely on the navy until they had built up an army. And then when the war ended, typically what the British would do was instantly to dissolve their army, send all their men home, and immediately eliminate the wartime taxes that had been established to pay the war's expenses. Well, this new national debt that had accrued during the French and Indian War made these steps impossible. Yes, the British did demobilize their army in the wake of the Seven Years' War, but they couldn't eliminate the wartime taxes because they now had to finance service this new national debt. Of course, when I say service, I don't mean pay it off. What I mean is essentially pay the interest. That's all the British wanted to do. They didn't actually have a goal of paying off their national debt from the Seven Years' War. Nowadays, you sometimes hear people say that reckless fiscal steps that are being taken by the federal government in Washington, D.C. are going to inure to the detriment of our children and grandchildren. This is the way people commonly put it. Well, I'm worried about the way this is going to affect our children and grandchildren. And I like to point out that saying this is going to affect our children and grandchildren is actually too optimistic. Because if you lived in Britain today, you'd be paying debt service on a national debt that dated back to the Seven Years' War, which ended in 1763. So you have to think beyond your children and grandchildren when you're thinking about a permanent national debt. Anyway, the British government faced a substantial problem in the wake of the Seven Years' War because they could not eliminate the wartime taxes and keep the same kind of fiscal structure they'd always had. Now, this was a notable political problem within Britain because of the way that the House of Commons worked. Of course, in British government, there were three main national political institutions. You had the monarchy, which was, of course, a hereditary monarchy. You have a House of Lords. You had a House of Lords in 1763 that was made up predominantly of people who had inherited those positions. So, you know, if you were the Earl of something or the Duke of something or the Baron of something, then likely you were the oldest son of the previous fellow in that line at the time of his death. You were his oldest male survivor in a direct line. Although there were some people who were appointed to these positions by the king, who had the power anytime he wanted to elevate as many people as he wanted to the peerages, still the House of Lords was mainly a hereditary institution. The third major institution in British national politics in 1763 was the House of Commons. And The way that one became a member of the House of Commons was by winning a parliamentary election. Britain actually, in 1763, was one of the most democratic societies in the world, because nearly 10% of the adult males of sound mind in Britain were eligible to vote. And that sounds like a paltry number to us, but in a time when in Spain and France and Russia and Turkey, they didn't have any elections at all, parliamentary body in which 10% of the people of the adult males of sound mind in the kingdom were represented was actually quite substantial representation. But who were the people who were eligible to vote for members of the House of Commons? Well, they were the substantial landowners. So the way that one qualified for the suffrage, that is the qualification on voting, was a property qualification. In order to cast a vote for the House of Commons, one had to provide substantial evidence that he had a certain significant annual income. So it was really the wealthiest people among the commons who were eligible to cast votes for members of the House of Commons. And this was going to be a substantial issue. Why would it be a substantial issue? Well, the reason was, again, at the end of the Seven Years' War, they found they couldn't eliminate the wartime taxes because they had to service this new debt. And who were the people who were going to have to continue to pay the wartime taxes? Well, they were essentially the very same people who were eligible to vote for the House of Commons. So then as now, people who were in elected office were apt to respond to pressures from their constituents. And when electors for the House of Commons made clear to the members of the House of Commons that they wanted to see something done about this situation in which the taxes had not been reduced to peacetime levels at the end of the war, they cast about for some alternative way to fund the debt. And the solution that somebody came up with was, well, how about if we tax those colonists in North America? You know, those colonists in North America actually have been the chief beneficiaries of the late war, because what's happened here is that finally, after over a century of close proximity, the French colonial apparatus had been ejected from North America, and that meant the people in Connecticut and Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York, didn't have to worry about being attacked by the French. People who lived in the westernmost parts of settled North America and English-speaking North America didn't have to worry about having the French king's Indian allies sicked upon them from the West. And so, hey, these people aren't paying any taxes at all. They never had been directly taxed by the Parliament, and they're the chief beneficiaries. Why not tax them? So in 1764, Parliament passed something that was called the Sugar Act. This act was going to be a new attempt to levy a tax on importation of molasses into the North American English-speaking colonies. There had always been a supposed tax on importation of molasses, but what had happened in America is that there had developed a long-standing tradition of smuggling molasses from Caribbean colonies of His Majesty. And so while there purportedly was a higher tax on molasses importation, effectively very little of imported molasses was actually being taxed. So what the Sugar Act attempted to do was to lower the rate of tax on imported molasses, and at the same time to begin actually to enforce the rate of tax on imported molasses. There were people in politics, people who were prominent in society in North America, who were going to be significantly affected by that. One prominent firm in Boston was named Hutchinson and Nephew. And the Hutchinson, the nephew, was a fellow, Thomas Hancock and nephew. And the fellow who was the nephew in that situation was a guy named John Hancock, who ultimately would succeed to his uncle at his uncle's death as the controller of the most substantial mercantile firm in New England. That is, John Hancock would eventually become the wealthiest man in New England, chiefly because he had inherited this firm from his uncle. His uncle had long been in the business of importing things mainly from England, but also smuggling, among other things, molasses. So anyway, when news got to North America that there was going to be this new tax on importation of molasses, there was resistance, there were protests, there was a boycott, and Parliament decided they would appeal the tax. But that didn't mean they were going to give up the project. The next year, in 1765, Parliament came back with another tax to be levied in the colonies. The idea here was to narrow the incidence of a tax. Now, incidence of a tax is a technical economic term that's used to refer to the distribution of a tax's burden, the incidence of the tax. So, for example, in the first case, when they were trying to tax importation of molasses, at a time when not only do people use molasses in confections, as is done now, it's kind of brown stuff that you can put on baked goods, but the other way, the more common way that people consumed molasses in North America in the 18th century was as rum. People were very commonly devotees of rum consumption, and so the Parliament found that the distribution of this burden of the tax was going to be very broad. Well, the next year, in 1765, Parliament took a second pass on taxing the colonists. This time, they tried to find a way to structure a tax that would have a far narrower incidence. And the way they did that was with what came to be called the Stamp Act. The Stamp Act was supposed to establish a tax on various kinds of paper. Paper that was being used in publishing newspapers, paper that was being used in filing legal documents in court, paper that was being used to print college diplomas, paper that was being used in printing playing cards. Now, what kind of people were going to be filing papers in court, filing legal documents, filing land titles, graduating from college at a time when, for example, Massachusetts had exactly one college, Harvard, and it was graduating about 12 people a year, right? What kind of people were going to be among those 12 people? Well, of course, the answer is chiefly the wealthy, the well-connected. And you can see that Parliament's idea here was, well, okay, the Sugar Act met with broad resistance because most people thought they were going to be affected by it, but if we only tax the rich, then maybe we would get away with this. What happened instead, however, was that in 1765, the Stamp Act met with very broad resistance. So Parliament hired people to be stamp agents, that is, to go to each of the 13 North American English-speaking colonies and distribute this paper. Parliament bought the paper, Parliament had it stamped, Parliament hired shipping companies, and there was transportation of the paper to each of the North American colonies. And the Stamp Act met with three different kinds of resistance, or I should say resistance on three levels. First, at the most local, most popular level, there were boycotts organized first in the area around Boston and in the area known as Tidewater, Virginia. That is the coastal region of Virginia among the four major rivers in coastal Virginia. We're going to see that Tidewater and Boston people are going to take the lead in American resistance to British policy, each for obviously substantially different reasons. But anyway, there was a boycott, and it was like the boycott the year before resulting from the Sugar Act. It was very successful. Another kind of resistance to the Stamp Act came at the level of the colonial legislatures. Several legislatures propounded formal objections to the Stamp Act. So, for example, in the case of Virginia, which had a very hidebound, conservative, hierarchical House of Burgesses, that is, elected branch of its colonial government legislature, in Virginia, a new delegate who was in literally his first week in the House of Burgesses, and that was a no-no. You weren't supposed to do this kind of thing, certainly so early in your career, but Patrick Henry, who was going to become the most prominent Virginia politician of the Revolution, arguably of America during the Revolution, Patrick Henry, in his first week in the House of Burgesses, put forward a set of resolutions against the Stamp Act. And the argument he made against it was going to come to be a kind of standard American argument against British policy in the 1760s and 70s. What Henry said was, from the beginning of Virginia, Virginians have had conceded to them by the kings of England certain rights. Henry said, if you went back to the first Virginia charters at the very beginning of the 17th century in 1611 and 1613, you'd find that the kings of England had said that their subjects in the colony of Virginia were going to have the same rights as their subjects in the Kingdom of England. Henry said, among those rights are the right to be tried before juries and the right not to be taxed by anybody except our own representatives. Henry also went on to say that anybody who tried to enforce the Stamp Act within the colony of Virginia should be considered as an enemy to His Majesty's colony. Now here we come to the distinction that I think is more or less lost in American conception between a criminal and an outlaw. Right? A criminal is somebody who has broken the law. An outlaw, on the other hand, is somebody who is beyond the law's protection. So it used to be that in case states or kingdoms or colonies, government decided, well, we have this outlaw, but we can't catch him, they would declare him to be an outlaw. Let's think of the famous tales of Robin Hood, for example. Robin Hood was an outlaw hanging out in Sherwood Forest and committing various crimes that the king would like to have had him captured for committing. An outlaw is somebody who, having been identified as such by the government, then is beyond the government's protection. What that means is that in case you were to encounter such a person, you would be free to rape, beat, rob, murder, kidnap, torture, you know, commit arson against that person, and the government would do nothing to you for it. Well, when Patrick Henry said in the Virginia House of Burgesses that this should be the wages of people who tried to enforce the Stamp Act within His Majesty's kingdom, there was vehement opposition from leading figures in the House of Burgesses. The Speaker didn't like the idea. The treasurer of the colony, who was also a member of the House of Burgesses, didn't like the idea. Chief committee chairman in the House of Burgesses didn't like the idea, but when they took the vote, the resolutions passed anyway. Henry, who was a young man and a tobacco planter, like virtually everybody else in the House of Burgesses, had to go home to his... This was very common in Virginia. People would go to the House of Burgesses and they would do their business and they would leave because it commonly met about the time when you needed to go home for the harvest. So Henry went home to his plantation, and then the next day the Speaker called for a new vote on these resolutions, and ultimately the Burgesses decided not to have that one about the enforcers of the Stamp Act being considered enemies to His Majesty's colony. They decided to have that one not be the official position of Virginia. But by that point, it was too late, because what had happened was that the word of the original vote passing these resolutions made its way by a ship that happened to be in port in Virginia at the time that day, made its way ultimately to the Netherlands, to Scotland, to other colonies, and even to England itself, where people knew that the main colony in North America, the most lucrative, the most populous, the most extensive of His Majesty's colonies, Virginia, had gone on record to the effect that they were going to consider that it was essentially a crime to be involved in enforcing the Stamp Act in Virginia. So that was the intermediate level of resistance. That is, resolutions against the Stamp Act from some of the colonial legislatures. Finally, a third and the highest level of resistance, maybe you'd say the most refined, the most theoretical, most prominent level of resistance to the Stamp Act, was a Congress that met in New York City at the request of the legislature of Massachusetts. Massachusetts called for what was to be known as a Stamp Act Congress. Now notice this word Congress. A Congress historically was not what we think of a Congress being now. Nowadays we think of the government in Washington as being a national legislature, right? But In the 18th century, the word Congress referred to a meeting of ambassadors. And in fact, there have been two highly famous congresses in European history. One that ended in 1648, the Congress of Westphalia decided the 30 Years' War. And the other one, meeting beginning in 1815, the Congress of Vienna decided how to draw the new internal map of Europe in the wake of Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo. So these were meeting places of the ambassadors of the major, and in case of Vienna, the minor states of Europe. So there's Massachusetts calling for a Stamp Act Congress, and ultimately in 1766, delegates from nine colonies met in New York and adopted resolutions concerning the Stamp Act. These were not radical as Henry's were, but they were written by a very moderate American patriot named John Dickinson from Pennsylvania. Dickinson was an attorney from Philadelphia who was going to play a very prominent role in the Revolution, ultimately be involved in writing the U.S. Constitution. He was for a brief time a general in the Revolutionary Army. But what Dickinson did for the Stamp Act Congress was to write a set of really moderate resolutions spelling out the colonial constitutional position. First, the Stamp Act Congress's resolutions began by saying, "We admire Your Majesty and his family, and we love the Protestant succession." Now, notice what this means is that these people were certainly not thinking of independence. Sometimes I think we have the false idea that from the first, the Americans were thinking, oh, how could we get independence? What would we need to do to break away from the King of England? But one very prominent historian of these matters has said that the North American colonists were never so patriotic as they were in 1763. That is, they were never so patriotically British. They identified themselves as British. When John Dickinson's resolutions said, "We admire Your Majesty and his family and we love the Protestant succession," he was essentially saying, we love our kingdom, we love our king, we love our political tradition, we're glad we're free, and we think that's because the government is, among other things, avowedly Protestant. So you can kind of imagine Dickinson on behalf of the Stamp Act Congress, or you can imagine the Stamp Act Congress in general in adopting these resolutions as kind of doffing its hat and taking a big bow to the king, right? We're standing here with our hat in hand, bowing to Your Majesty. But the second thing that the Stamp Act Congress said was, "We also have the right of your subjects in Great Britain." And then they went on to say, among those rights they claimed were the right to trial by jury and the right to be taxed only by their own representatives. And then there was a very, very significant passage. This is one that's often overlooked. You know, nowadays we might think, well, okay, there's this quarrel between colonists in North America and the king and parliament in England, and how could that be resolved? One way might be just have parliamentary elections in North America and send members of parliament from North America. You know, today there are members of Congress in Washington who represent Hawaii. Hawaii is much farther from Washington, D.C. than Parliament was from Williamsburg or Charlestown, from Philadelphia or Boston. Why not just elect members of Parliament from North America and send them to England? And the answer had to do with difficulty in transportation. And nowadays you can fly from New York to London in about 5 hours, but in the 18th century, if you wanted to travel from Boston to England, it took about 4 or 5, maybe even 6 weeks. And that depended on the weather. And then it was slower in the other direction because the current only goes one way. We're talking about the age of sailing ships, recall. So the next passage of the Stamp Act Congress's resolution said, because we cannot be represented in Parliament, we have to be taxed only by our own colonial legislatures. So this was the position that the Stamp Act Congress took at the very beginning. What's going to happen over the following 10 years leading down to the outbreak of actual fighting between the colonies and the mother country in 1775, what's going to happen is that there are going to be repeated iterations of this argument, right? Parliament trying to tax the colonists saying, "Oh, you can't do that, you're violating our rights," Parliament trying to do it in some other way, and there's going to be a kind of ratcheting up of mutual recrimination, ultimately animosity, and then finally there's going to be development of the feeling that, well, the colonies just have to be independent because Parliament's never going to concede that people who live in North America have all the rights of Englishmen, as Patrick Henry had claimed in 1765. Anyway, despite the fact, or maybe regardless of the fact, that these formal resolutions have been adopted, it seems that what really affected the understanding of people in the English political elite when it came to the questions of the constitutionality and the desirability of the Stamp Act was the boycott. Remember who was represented in the House of Commons. One historian calculated that tens of thousands of Englishmen were thrown out of work by the boycott on all English goods that was associated with resistance to the Stamp Act. So as these people are being laid off, pressure built on the House of Commons to do something about the Stamp Act. Ultimately, one day in 1766 in the House of Commons, they took a vote, and they voted to repeal the Stamp Act. However, there was a serious constitutional difficulty here. Nowadays, if an American wants to go see the U.S. Constitution and the actual document that was written in Philadelphia and ultimately signed by George Washington, James Madison, Ben Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, and all those famous guys who wrote it, all he has to do is go to Washington, D.C., to a place called the National Archives, walk in and see that the document is sitting right there. But if he wanted to go see the British Constitution in 1766, the problem was impossible to solve because the British did not have a written constitution. Written constitutions were invented by Americans in response to this quarrel. So the word constitution was used by people in England to refer not to a written document that people had subscribed on one particular day, but to the collection of habits, customs, basic laws that had been adopted in England over many, 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 many centuries. And it was unwritten, and that meant that, for example, at least some people were concerned in Parliament that it meant that if Britain adopted a policy taxing the colonies, the colonists responded by saying, you can't do that, it's unconstitutional. And then Britain repealed the law. Next time around, the colonists would be able to say, well, we've established that it's unconstitutional for you to do this. Remember, we had that argument, and ultimately Parliament repealed the law because it was unconstitutional. So, as I said, one day in 1766 in the House of Commons, they had a vote, and they voted to repeal the Stamp Act. And then in the very next vote, they voted to adopt something called the Declaratory Act. And what the Declaratory Act of 1766 said was, His Majesty's subjects in the North American colonies are subject to the King and Parliament of Great Britain, which are entitled to legislate for them, quote, in all cases whatsoever. Notice that the colonists have been making particular arguments about what their rights were. Recall Patrick Henry had said, since the beginning of Virginia's settlement, the kings of England have recognized that their subjects in Virginia would have all the rights of Englishmen. But if Parliament were entitled to legislate for Virginia, quote, in all cases whatsoever, then what rights would Virginians have? What, in other words, what assertion could they make against legislation adopted by Parliament that would have any legal weight? And the answer is, well, none, right? None. Because the idea of rights implies that there are some things, there are some policies the government just can't adopt. There are some things the government just can't do. And where the British had a policy or had a position that Parliament was sovereign, that it had unlimited authority throughout the empire, and it could legislate not only for the North American colonists, but for anybody else in the British Empire in all cases whatsoever, that meant that they were denying that the colonists had any rights at all. So when word of the repeal of the Stamp Act made its way to North America, there were celebrations in Boston, Hartford, in New York, in Philadelphia, in Annapolis, in Williamsburg, in Charlestown, and so on. But then there were some people who thought, well, you know, things aren't really that much improved because here we've got our statement that we have these certain rights and there's some things Parliament can't do. And then they've responded by saying, essentially, no, we can do those things. We can do anything we want. We can legislate for you. And these are words that were going to become infamous in North America, quote, in all cases whatsoever. So, as I said before, what was going to happen repeatedly over the following several years was that the British would try over and over and over again to find some way to raise revenue in North America to help service the debt that had accrued during the French and Indian War, during the Seven Years' War. And the American colonists were never going to agree to be taxed by Parliament. That didn't mean that they were saying we don't expect to help pay the cost of the British Empire. In fact, repeatedly they said things to the effect of, well, if you would just tell us how much money you want, we would voluntarily contribute to the expense of the British Empire. In New York, for example, New York's legislature said during the late Seven Years' War, His Majesty repeatedly asked for men and money from his colony of New York, and we actually provided more men and more money than was requested. So it's not that we're quibbling here because we just want to avoid paying any taxes. Rather, the question is where authority lies. The Americans were going to say, if there is a person or if there is an institution that is entitled to tell us what to do in all cases whatsoever, then the situation in which we find ourselves is slavery. And that's the word they used for it, slavery. Slavery meant a situation in which somebody else can tell you what to do in any way he wants. And you might think, well, there's something, in fact, one famous English writer said, why do we hear the loudest yelps for liberty from the drivers of slaves? So you might think there's something a little bit, shall we say, awkward in having slave owners lecturing people in England where there was no slavery at all, where the law said that the air of England was too free for a slave to breathe. It might seem somewhat awkward for them to be lecturing such people about slavery, but one of the prominent American revolutionaries who later would be an even more prominent statesman in the early Republican period, Edmund Randolph of Virginia, later wrote a book called A History of Virginia, and when he got to this question, he said, well, it's probably true that because we owned slaves, because we saw every day what slavery was like, we were touchier about our rights than we otherwise would have been. Because we saw what it was like to be in such an abject position, we were determined from the beginning that we weren't going to be subjected to that. So, yes, well, right, it was awkward from the point of view of the English, and there were going to be points at which it seemed awkward to the Americans. If you flash forward a little bit, what happened over time was that there were increasingly heated confrontations. There were kind of flash points. One of them was Boston, where you had leadership in the local government, especially Sam Adams, who nowadays is remembered as Brewer and Patriot, but in the 1760s and 70s might more accurately have been called radical Puritan extremist. People like Adams repeatedly brought matters to crisis by confronting the British, especially soldiers in the town. So, for example, ultimately Parliament decided to station a couple of regiments of His Majesty's troops on the town green in Boston. And then the local people would make a point whenever they found one or two of these guys out by himself to beat them up and so on. And there's an infamous episode in 1770 when a half a dozen of these guys were out and a huge throng of Bostonians gathered around them, calling them names, throwing ice and snow at them, and apparently rocks and who knows what. And anyway, apparently because these fellows were so frightened, ultimately one of them slipped and his musket discharged. The captain of this group later said that he was telling his men, don't fire, don't fire. But some of the men said they thought they were hearing people say, fire. And in fact, it seems that some of the Bostonians were taunting them, fire, fire. So the soldiers fired into the crowd and killed five of them. Adams then, seeing an opportunity, had handbills and broadsides printed up. Broadside was a poster you'd put up all over town with a political point on it. The broadside showed six coffins, five for the dead men and one for American liberty. That was Adams' way of describing what had happened here. And he denominated this event in 1770 the Boston Massacre, which of course gave a completely inaccurate impression that the British troops had set out one day hoping to find some civilians to shoot, and doesn't give you the information that, you know, really a throng set upon them. They rang church bells so that more men would come, and then they're throwing things at them and taunting them and so on. John Adams, Sam's cousin, far less radical than he, actually defended these men who were accused of murder in a Massachusetts court, and they were all acquitted, which John Adams thought demonstrated that Massachusetts really was a place where the rule of law prevailed. So that was the final resolution of the so-called Boston Massacre. In 1773, you have a similar episode where ultimately the Parliament had passed something called the Tea Act, yet another attempt to tax the colonies. And what they did there was, as in the case of the Sugar Act, they gave an exemption to particular taxes to people who were selling things in North America with the hope that maybe this way they could extend some funding to the East India Company, a British concern that governed India on behalf of the King of England. and at the same time establish the principle that the colonists could be taxed by Parliament. Hearing of this, Sam Adams decided to resist it. When the first ships carrying this tea that was exempted from these taxes made its way to Boston Harbor, the longshoremen who were allied with Sam Adams and the radical group in Boston would not unload the tea. The ship's captains decided, well, we have to leave Boston Harbor. If you have a wooden ship, you can't just kind of park it, because ultimately the timbers in the hull will deteriorate. So the captain decides, well, if I can't unload the tea here, I have to get out of here. But the governor, Thomas Hutchinson, who was a loyalist and opposed to radicals like Adams, would not give the captain the ship's papers to take the tea out of Boston Harbor. He told him, you can't have the papers until you've unloaded the tea. What to do then? I can't leave. I can't unload the tea. What am I supposed to do? The ultimate conclusion came one night in December of 1773, when a number of local men, apparently disguised in Indian garb, made their way onto these ships and dumped the tea into the Boston Harbor. They actually did this with the intention of not committing any crimes other than breaking and entering and theft of the tea. Or you might say, well, this is treason, because they're doing it to prevent enforcement of Parliament's policies. But anyway, one of the participants, it seems, could not resist and stuffed his pockets full of the tea. When the other participants found out that he had done this, they stripped him naked and made him walk home. There you are in the winter in Boston, and you're naked and snowy out. And, well, that was quite a severe punishment for that fellow. We don't actually know who participated, because the men had sworn them, they'd sworn each other to secrecy. They all promised they would never reveal each other's identities. We have one guy who in the 1830s, in his 90s, finally said, well, I was one of the men at Boston Harbor. But who knows whether that was actually true. Now, in 1774, Thomas Jefferson, a young Virginia Burgess, wrote a document that came to be known as a Summary View of the Rights of British America. And he, perturbed with the Parliament's treatment of the colonies, finally had decided that really the colonists should make clear that they didn't have any interest in observing any policy adopted by Parliament at all. Here we had, once again, at the behest of Massachusetts, a coming meeting of what was going to be called the First Continental Congress. Actually, they just called it the Continental Congress, not knowing there'd be another one. But here, once again, the point was to coordinate resistance to British policy. Thomas Jefferson wrote instructions for the Virginia delegates to this coming Congress that were ultimately published as a pamphlet entitled A Summary View of the Rights of British America. If we contrast Jefferson's summary view to John Dickinson's resolves of the Stamp Act Congress 8 years earlier, we can see how the attitude of Americans toward the mother country had changed, right? In Jefferson's summary view, there's no taking off your hat and bowing. There's no saying we love you and your family. There's none of we have all the duties of your subjects in Great Britain and so on that John Dickinson had laid out in the Stamp Act Congress's resolutions. Instead, Jefferson says that he wants the Virginia congressman to tell the king that the king is the people's servant. He has his office for their good. He wants them to tell the King of England that the British Empire can be a happy one if well poised. In other words, his idea is that the only common link among the various parts of the British Empire, Jamaica, Bermuda, Bahamas, India, Hanover, Scotland, Virginia, England itself, the only common link among them is that they have the same king. He says each of those areas has its own local legislature, and the problem that's been encountered by the North American colonists is that the people who are in one part's legislature wanted to legislate for them. Well, he says, they don't have any right to be doing this, and you, King George, should intervene and prevent this from happening. And he says, let those flatter who fear. It is not an American art. So Jefferson's very pugnacious here. He's very confrontational. You can kind of imagine that George III, if he ever encountered this document, and we don't know that he did, but if he had, you can kind of imagine him kind of hearing it or reading it and thinking, what? Tobacco farmer? Virginia? Where's Virginia? What? You know, but on the other hand, Jefferson had come to the point where he could say, as he said in a summary view, that the legislature of Great Britain was foreign to our constitutions and unknown to our laws. Now, his point was that Parliament didn't have any rightful authority in North America at all. And essentially what he's envisioning here is what in the 19th century would come to be called the Dominion Theory of the Second British Empire, the one after the American Revolution, where, you know, all the different parts of the empire had the same Queen Victoria, but you didn't have the legislature of India trying to legislate for people in England or anything like that. So this is a very different kind of situation. Well, ultimately, essentially, the British were not going to give up their theory that their parliament was sovereign and so could legislate in all cases whatsoever for anybody in any part of the British Empire. And the Americans were not going to retract their position or even modify it, that they could only be legislated for by their own representatives and they had a right to trial by jury and so on. And so ultimately in 1775, when delegates from the Massachusetts political elite were going to the Continental Congress, the governor of Massachusetts decided he was going to take radical steps in response. Now, the governor of Massachusetts was, by this time, an English general. And the way that that happened had to do with the parliamentary response to this so-called Tea Party that I described in December of 1773. Parliament, in response to the Tea Party, decided it had had enough. And so they adopted a suite of four of what they called coercive acts, which Sam Adams, with his genius for propaganda, soon would dub the Intolerable Acts. The coercive acts included, one, the Massachusetts Government Act that completely remade the Massachusetts government. And so for the first time, instead of having an elected governor, the governor of Massachusetts, the people of Massachusetts would have a governor appointed by the king. Instead of having the upper house of Massachusetts legislature be elected by the lower house, who were elected by the people, the upper house of the Massachusetts legislature would be appointed by the governor. And instead of having resistance coordinated through town meetings that had met ever since Massachusetts Bay Colony was founded, the town meetings could only meet if the governor pre-approved their agendas. So here you have essentially, instead of a Republican government of the kind Massachusetts had long been used to, you have substituted for it essentially a military dictatorship with a general as governor and no independent body that could speak for the people of Massachusetts. Well, Adams and John Hancock, Sam Adams and John Hancock opposed this. They were going to participate in the Continental Congress. At that point, there had already apparently been people in England who said, well, the two of them should be arrested and sent to England for trial as traitors. And so one day in April of 1775, the governor of Massachusetts, whose name was General Thomas Gage, heard that Adams and Hancock were in Concord, Massachusetts. He then sent military forces up the road through Lexington to Concord in order to arrest. The idea was they were going to be arrested in Lexington, and then the army was going to go on to Concord, which is past Lexington on the same road, where the colonial store of gunpowder was being stored. Governor Gage decided that he could decapitate and disarm the resistance by arresting Hancock and Adams and taking the gunpowder. What, you know, we all know the famous story that by this point, patriots in and around Boston were watching out for the British to march out into the countryside. And so famously, a signal system had been worked out. Paul Revere saw that the signal was that these men were going to move by land. And so he rode out into the countryside warning people that the British were coming. How this had an effect on the events that were going to come was that by the time the British forces got to Lexington, Adams and Hancock had already been warned the British were coming, and so they absconded. What the military met in Lexington instead of these two Continental congressmen waiting to be arrested was the town militia drawn up on the town green. The Marine major in charge of the British force, whose name was Pitcairn, instructed the militiamen to disperse. Their militia colonel then told them not to disperse. The major told them again to disperse, and their colonel told them not to disperse. At that point, somebody, we don't know who, fired a shot. This is the one that was famously dubbed the shot heard around the world. There then was an exchange of fire, apparently. Many American militiamen were knocked down, and as the British marched across this field, they bayoneted several of the Americans lying there on the ground. They then made their way up to Concord, where by this point the local militia had been warned that the British were coming, and so they too were ready. If you wanted to go into Concord in those days, you had to cross a bridge, and so on the other end of the bridge were the Concord militiamen. There was an exchange of fire. Ultimately, the British decided to turn around and head back to Boston. And here's where the fighting really started, because what happened as the British marched back to Boston was that men assembled from all over Massachusetts, eastern Massachusetts, men assembled on that road and took shots at British soldiers from behind barns, from under bridges, from behind trees. Ultimately, there were going to be people from Rhode Island, Connecticut, and all over eastern Massachusetts who followed the British, hundreds of whom were shot on the way back into Boston, followed the British and ringed the city. So effectively, by the end of April 1775, Governor Gage was governor of Boston, and the rest of eastern and southern New England was in rebellion. So started the American Revolution.